Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
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 Yes, sci-fi, sci-fi, sci-fi. A podcast that this week will probably result in the deaths of at least three people.
Probably the...
Me, and me.
The multiple hosts, yes.
Me and my two sniper dolls.
Exactly.
We might be able to get through it, I don't know.
We might.
Let's try really hard.
So, yes, hello and welcome to Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast in which we each week review another science fiction audiobook. This week, we are reviewing Seven Surrenders by Ada Palmer, and we're really happy about it.
I love being happy.
I can't tell if that's maudlin terror or something else.
Great. Yes, so Seven Surrenders is part of the Terra Ignota series, and I'll start by giving my opinion, since I think it's the one that will not have the most screams of incoherent rage.
There were words.
There were words. So this is the sequel to Two Like the Lightning, and it takes place in an 18th century that has been transported to the far future, a world that on the surface is supposed to be very gender neutral, and that leaves it open to manipulation by gendered individuals. And
the horror. is it you know, like the liberal, you know, fantasy gone completely amok?
It's hard to tell. There's a lot of back and forth on that. So believe it or not, I actually liked this book. It was tough going for a while because there are some pacing issues, and it isn't quite so interesting as a standalone book as the first one, because Two Like the Lightning does quite a bit of world building. It's pretty much all world building, and the world building is interesting because this is a science fiction, well, kind of a science fiction landscape that is not like anything else that I've ever read.
It's a genderless lace punk adventure.
Something like that. I think that the best way to think of it is it's not really science fiction. It may take place in the future and there may be flying cars, but really science fiction is not kind of the contract it's trying to fulfill. It's almost a theological novel and in some ways a weird parody of Voltaire's Candide. So I kind of reservedly like it because on her website, Ada Palmer freely admits, this book is not for everyone. It is a book where there are tremendous descriptions of exactly what everybody is wearing at all times and exactly the social implications of what those clothes mean. And it spends a lot of time building up the world. And sometimes the information that you get is approximately the wrong side of the book from where you needed it. So we find out, for example, what a group called OS... So there's a group called OS, and we discover...
Is this a spoiler?
I'm not entirely sure if we do exactly find out what it stands for, but we learn the significance of OS much, much after it is first introduced.
I'm pretty sure I still don't know what OS stands for.
Exactly.
I mean, I know what it stands for as an acronym, but where they want to go, I still have no idea.
And there's still some loose ends, and it turns out that this is all a theological novel. And so I didn't have the same kind of glee that I had sort of reading through the first one because it was just so different from anything that I'd ever read before. And I kind of wish that this had just been put as a single novel with the first one and maybe tightened up a little bit.
It could have just been three times as long as the first one because this was twice as long.
Exactly.
Yes, so, I will say that that was part of my problem was the first book, at least, while I didn't enjoy it, the first book at least had
right
new things. Now this had like repetition of that, some of that stuff. So it kind of like lost even that spark.
Right. So I would say, first of all, I don't think that this is a good audiobook. I think that reading it as an audiobook makes it a lot harder because you have to go through and, you know, go back and forth and figure out, where did they define the term porphyrogene? What does this word mean? You know, she's making up a new language as she goes along, and she doesn't always get the explanations in place immediately before she actually uses it. So I would recommend reading this one in at least ebook form, if not paperback form, And the first time you read it, I would just let it wash over you. Do not try to understand it. There is a long phase in the middle where people are just talking about gibberish. It is all just sort of background information. And
I could not tell if I needed to know some of these things. And my brain just got overloaded with too many bits of information, I guess.
Yes.
This person was revealed to be somebody else that I didn't know either one.
I have to own up that I texted that one out myself. Oh my gosh. It turns out that person A is secretly person B. Who are these people? I don't know. Do I care? I'm not sure.
You might later.
So anyway, yes, my opinion is a qualified recommend for anybody that likes extremely complex books.
Was it more complex than Arcadia?
It was not less perfect than Lore.
You needed an app to understand that one.
or the
Arcadia
historical...
Arcadia was actually very straightforward.
Yes, that was just sort of like child's play by comparison. Yes, if you like, you know, French history and the court, French court, then this would be an awesome book for you as kind of my review. Otherwise, please don't.
What was it that you said at the end when... A.U. Dibble, the voice of Audible, said, I hope you enjoyed this book.
Yes, and in fact, that's true. I was going to mention that. The last thing where it's like, you know, Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program. And it's like, sorry, Audible, that didn't happen this time.
Yeah, this time when the book shows up like that and I said, don't tell me what to do.
All right, so now to hear from people with different opinions than mine, let's hear from Barry.
I can't say that I recommend it.
It was a book you read?
It was a book that occurred.
Wow.
I didn't particularly care for it. I think, as I mentioned to you guys earlier, the dear reader part of the first part of this book, you know, where they continually speak to you as if, in my opinion, like they're talking kind of down to you, kind of got to me. I mean, that's just the way I felt about it. And it kind of put a negative spin on the book for me.
Well, right. This isn't an issue of, is the author skilled at putting words in a sequence? Because, you know, probably the answer is yes. It's whether I like that particular sequence. And in this case, the answer is no.
So we have now kind of a review of the book and a review of the concept of reviewing books and language.
Yes.
That's kind of oddly fitting, I guess.
I'd like to diagram Kevin's sentences.
That's the only way to get through them sometimes.
They're sort of recursive and like they might like close brace in half an hour later.
I thought they were just giant circles and you could read them in any order.
That's true also, but it's complicated.
Was that an arrival joke?
Yes, it was an arrival joke. Kind of like the first book where there are parts of it that I, you know, like this little section of it sounds cool. I would have liked it if it had gone more into, like you said, the science fiction portion, which it seemed to not really. Like, you know, let's find out more about the sets and about how the actual hives work outside of the French court and the sort of like weird inbred like leaders that were so like that one point towards the very end where we find out somebody's offspring, you know, is going to be raised by somebody else. And I'm like, what is going on? And who is this child? And like, and then you're like, oh, that's a flashback about J.E.D.D. Mason. And then I'm like, oh, okay, that makes sense. But somehow I missed that part. And it was just,
Yeah, here's a pro tip for reading through this book. If you don't know who somebody is, they're probably secretly J.E.D.D. Mason.
And what does J.E.D.D. stand for?
Jehovah, Epicurio, Damasio, D.R.U.A.
Thank you.
Good job.
And let's see. Jehovah, I don't know what that means. Jehovah.
Jumping Jehoshaphat.
Epicurio, Epicurious, you know, Epicurean, whatever. The third one is actually the Marquis de Sade's first name. And the fourth one is actually Voltaire's last name.
Good thing I knew all those facts after you mentioned them.
Well, I had to look up the third one. I don't really hang around with de Sade that much these days. Not after that he did. He stole $5 from me.
Stupid sniper. In retrospect, there are a lot of these like reveals are meant to be ground shaking. And I kind of think like, well, does this affect anything except the five leaders of the world or the seven or however many there are? Like, and it kind of felt like in their circles, it was like, OMG. And like everyone else would just be like, huh, what are you talking about?
Just like finding out that, you know, your Congress critter basically cheated on their spouse or something like that. You're like, okay, you're like, this changes my government. How?
By the way, did we ever figure out who stole the 710 list?
They did, actually. Someone said, I did. I don't remember who it was now. I actually don't really care. But someone was very gleefully admitting to it.
There was at least a chapter about it. Don't remember who it was, though.
Yeah, that's kind of like what I mean. It's like we finally get revealed, like, okay, this is actually why the 710 list and or like why this other stuff makes a difference, because we'll discuss it in the spoiler section, but you know, these people have been killing other people and it happened a long time ago too. And it's like, okay, that part, you know, fine. We get some mystery. But by that point I was just like, okay, they kind of explain it, but I don't care anymore.
I mean, right. Some of the elements just seem just like a little, like even a little too insane for us. You know, it's like the whole thing where, you know, one of the characters says, oh, I impregnated myself with your seed, but I did it secretly and then told you it was someone else that, you know, that I slept with. And I'm like, what?
So, yes, I believe that we have a parade of small army men that has coming in through the windows. And so it's time for us to take our break. And when we come back, we will go into our discussion section.
Army men, take me first.
Yay, because we are sci-fi.
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 All right, and welcome back to our discussion section, where we will discuss spoilerific things until we are all mysteriously transformed into other people by wearing costumes.
The cousins?
We can all be transformed into cousins, sure. All right, so what do we want to talk about?
Well,
where do we start?
Barry just brought up the that was sort of like maybe the first big, are you freaking kidding me? Are you like you know, in high school or something?
We do have the explicit tag on this podcast, don't we?
Yeah, yes. I know. It's this. So like that scene of, and I don't even know who it is now, and I don't know.
I don't even care anymore.
That woman, you know, it's like one of the leaders or the leader's wife or something.
Yeah. Well, it was you know, the prostitute who rules the world secretly.
Was it Madame
Heidi Fleiss?
Or was it like?
Well, the if you're talking about,
talking about the one who. Who, well, maybe were they talking about J.E.D.D. Mason? Because I don't have any idea.
So there's a big long scene, and this scene went on far too long, I'd be happy to admit, where everybody is talking about the fact that Madame Arouet is pregnant and she won't say exactly who the child's father is.
So the potential fathers get to like donate a name, isn't that right? That's how he came out with J.E.D.D. Because each one gets to say, well, this is an awesome name. Use that one.
Quite possibly. I think I kind of missed that part.
It's BKS Mason. God.
Yeah.
That's slightly terrifying. No, that is terrifying.
But, yes. I mean, she's basically using the fact that they don't know exactly who the father is yet, and they're just about to run the genetic test. She's using that fact to try to get this kid into everybody's court, because all the potential fathers that she's lined up in this particular scenario are leaders of the different hives.
It's kind of like a political version of Jerry Springer.
Yeah, it's a lot like that.
With less chairs.
Exactly.
And more flying cars that are controlled by other people.
Exactly. And this book has a really high opinion of the Marquis de Sade for some reason. And a lot of people do.
Hey, don't we all?
It's very fringe.
I really haven't read.
I think it's one of those, like, when you're 20, it's awesome.
It's something like that.
Basically, I haven't read any Marquis de Sade, and I don't really think that he's that interesting as a philosopher. But
I saw the movie.
What, Quills?
Yeah, it's totally correct, isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
it has to be because it was
a movie. It's on the internet too, so.
But yeah, then they raise J.E.D.D. Mason in this mysterious nunnery whorehouse entirely according to the teachings of the Marquis de Sade. And he turns out to be this very distant kid that by the age of 20, he seems to be able to just sort of tell you something and you believe it entirely. So, for example, this one woman that destroyed something, he said one phrase to her and she couldn't actually watch any movies anymore. He said something like, you know, the hero in every story is life and the villain is death or something like that. And she now can't watch anything without thinking about that and not being able to actually follow the plot, which may have been done to us right before we started this book. That would explain a bit.
I'm so deeply confused now.
Yeah, I don't remember that. She sounds a little too sensitive anyway.
That was in the previous book.
Oh, okay. I've excised that with like the scalpel on my brain. So yeah. So anyway, there's this scene where they're revealing something about the kid, you know, the kid's father. And it turns out that the father was her lover who she decided to test to see if, you know, loved her.
Different sequence.
Yes, to see if he loved her.
No, this is a different person in a different scene.
Yeah, and so...
it is revealed, like we said in the beginning, that secretly the prime minister of something or other, I think, was actually this other guy who... And that might have been quite a dramatic reveal if we had ever heard of the other guy, or if we hadn't just been...
If we had remembered hearing about the other guy before.
I don't think we ever had. I don't know for sure.
Oh, Jehovah, save me.
And it turned out that actually everybody already knew that person B was secretly person A, and they were just sort of playing along.
Yes, which made it even more awesome. So right, she decides to test when, you know, before, you know, she gets married, she's like, I'm going to test to see if my lover really loves me. And how will I do this? Well, I'll impregnate myself with his seed. And how will I get it? Well, he's secretly sleeping with my brother. And since everyone thinks I'm screwing my brother too, or something weird like that, or maybe that's just sort of like what came out of the result of this, she gets it from him, her brother.
That's got to be an awkward family conversation.
Yeah. Hey, buddy.
Hey, bro.
Do me a favor.
Well, they all hang out in this sort of weird sex dungeon all the time.
Yeah. So, yeah, so this
might have been an easier location. This might just be like, you know, so you having sex with my brother today?
Yeah.
I need a favor.
Exactly.
So anyway, like, she impregnates herself with the turkey baster or whatever. They kind of discuss that a little bit. And then when she reveals that she's pregnant, she, in her mind, he's supposed to say, I don't care that you slept with someone else because I love you so much and hooray, let's still get married. Instead, he like kind of beats her up or something.
Yeah.
So he reveals
pretty bad.
He kind of reveals how awesome he is at the same time that she reveals how like emotionally mature she is, or maybe she's beyond mature, one of the two. And like, then, you know, she marries the Mitsubishi guy or something instead.
Yes.
So that she could.
Hotoka Ando Mitsubishi.
Yes, be a mover and shaker or
whose
whatever.
Whose initials are Ham. I was seeing.
Squee like a pig.
Anyway, I was just, you know, you never know what is going to be what in this book. And the initials seem to be a thing. So I was just like, well, what are his initials? So his initials are Ham. Does that mean anything? Probably not.
H-A-M. Is H-A-M-M or H-A-M?
Just H-A-M.
It's the beer. Hams.
He's secretly played by John Hamm.
So, right. Then years later, I guess, like, she kind of tells this to him. And then, of course, he's devastated or whatever. I don't remember, but it was just sort of like at that point, I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? Wow, this was actually a plot point, and this was like your great grand are you in love with me test. I'm like,
that's the long con.
And yeah, it felt, that's when I'm like, this feels like I'm watching a telenovela of which I've never watched before, and I really don't care about any of the characters, and they're just like, everything's so melodramatic and goofy.
I do have a television,
and I'm just like, oh god,
it's like old school Days of Our Lives with, like, you know, what is it, Delancey and
yeah,
time travel and
Well, and there's probably some explanation as to, this is probably sort of, you know, parodying or, you know, a reference to some literary thing going on.
Right. I feel like this is like the ultimate, you know, historical commentary or something that I'm totally missing it. So probably if you're like, wow, you're such a freaking idiot that you don't get how awesome this is.
Are you saying I'm not smart enough to understand this book? Because I didn't understand it.
It's like, you know, if you don't have the basis for this illusion, then you just don't get it. But if you do, it's really awesome. And, you know, I'm willing to believe that's the case.
Like, there's like 15 people on the planet that have read the book and they're, you know, rolling on the floor laughing at this thing.
You know, it's like either a telenovela or it felt like this is a Looney Tunes cartoon if they had tried to make serious, you know, stuff, but they still left in all the bizarre slapstick stuff, but it was still really serious.
I impregnated myself.
Ringtone.
And that's all, folks.
I will now shoot you with a JEDD doll bullet, which I don't think actually happened, but no. I swear that's what they said.
So
only in the fleshy part, please.
Let me just talk about something that I liked actually in this book, which was after all of this stuff happens and there are huge breaks where everybody has to talk to each other, and it's basically the part of the anime where everybody is talking about high school drama when monsters are attacking and that sort of thing. And
right.
Then we get to the end. It turns out that Sniper has been part of this group of people that's been secretly killing people to prevent war from breaking out. And then Bridger takes off and he's on the run and he can bring things to life. And of course, there's all these Sniper dolls around because that's the entire point of Sniper's existence.
Right. He's like a living doll that everyone just sort of follow, you know, they follow his Twitter feed or whatever, his video feed.
I think like even in the first book, they said like every family has like is like their most treasured possession is a Sniper doll or something.
Right. Exactly.
Which is just weird. But okay.
Yeah, I didn't get that then. I still don't get it now.
Yeah, it was one of those things that paid off that I wasn't even remotely expecting, which is Bridger suddenly brings to life all these Sniper dolls and starts freaking out because then they're acting like Sniper and they're going around shooting people and they kill J.E.D.D. Mason. But Bridger is around and brings him back to life. And then finally, the plot is moving. And I thought that that sequence was kind of awesome. The other thing that I thought was kind of awesome was
the museum full of Sniper dolls. Here's a World War I scene completely reenacted by a bunch of Sniper dolls. Yeah,
exactly. It was sort of this, well, how far can I pile this on? And I thought it was kind of fun.
Sniper dolls all the way down.
Pretty much. And so once that started, I thought that there was some interesting stuff going on. It still was a little bit hard to follow, but at least towards the end, I felt that there was some action going on and we were seeing some kind of progression.
Yeah, I'd say like the last hour, like it picked up significantly.
Yes.
Well, yeah, 4.5 hours from the end, that's when J.E.D.D. Mason meets his temporary doom.
Right.
And so, yeah, it kind of picked up after that point. Before that, it was just like, oh, God, I can barely get through this at 3x speed.
Well, you can. You just don't understand it.
Right. I can understand it, sadly, but it was for this book anyway, but it was, I was just like, please, just could we make it go faster?
Must go faster.
I know. Please, Audible, put in a 4x speed. Yeah, I will say the one missed opportunity, or maybe it's a future thing. There's this bizarre sequence where they talked about how Apollo, which was like the person that they killed, you know, way in the past to kind of start this whole bloodshed to prevent war. You know, Apollo was one of the guys who had this secret plan to start war so that a future war would be not as bad, because if you have a war every once in a while, you'll still have people that remember what war is like.
Right. And he was this very revered figure.
Yeah. He was like one of the Mars clique, whatever the opiums. What was it? The other O word.
Right.
Not an O face.
God.
Word the humanists?
No. Wasn't he one of the ones? I thought the Mars clique was the God. Well, you know, there was only 7 hives. I can't
Utopians.
Remember 7 things. Utopians. Okay. Well, there's an O in there somewhere. U and O. They're very similar.
It's just missing a hat.
See, it's because the graphic has several like O looking things in it. Anyway,
he means circles.
Yes, circles. Circles look like O's. Anyway, Apollo had half rewritten the Iliad, and there's a secret book that Bridger has, the Iliad. That, you know, what is it? The Emperor gets pissed because our gentle narrator
Mycroft
yes has kept from him because he said, oh, it's a storybook, you wouldn't want to see it. And then finally he finds out that it's actually war plans for the future, and he gets really pissed and he's like, give it to me. He's like, you know, you promise on your life or whatever that it's not that. And then he broke down because he couldn't lie somehow. And then so he's like, actually it is a retelling of the Iliad, but it's just interspersed with, you know, war plans, but it was the Iliad fought on the moon and Mars with you know, giant robots. And
yeah, I thought that this,
and you know, I was like, if this whole book had been that, it would have been the most awesome book I'd ever read. Or like they could still make it into like an anime series, or like they could make it, you know, into a graphic novel or something. I mean, you know, if the next book is that, I will happily read it.
You know, as long as there's more mecha Kevin's in.
Yeah, and I'm not really like a mecha person. I mean, I watch anime, but like, you know, I'm not into.
I mean, he doesn't audibly grind gears when he moves, as far as we can tell. Yeah,
I would like to have.
He's more of a synthetic mecha,
a robot exoskeleton.
But wouldn't we all?
Yeah,
solve so many problems.
But I you know, I've never been one of those person that's like, wow, you know, giant robots are awesome. It's like they're just like, oh, whatever, you know, there's another science fiction thing. But the Iliad redone as giant robots, that would be awesome.
Yes, and in space.
Yes.
So I think I have a favorite scene now that I've had time to sit here and think about it a little bit more.
Okay.
And it was the one where they explain, it seemed like they tried to explain the Canner device, which is basically they synchronized people's heartbeats together using the trackers, right?
That wasn't quite the Canner device.
It's how they defeated the tracking, right?
Right. So how Canner could slip his tracker.
Yes.
Was he had a special pacemaker that he had made himself, well, along with Saladin.
Oh, God. I totally did not get that, except that towards the end they said, oh, God, his pacemaker, the EMP is going to kill him, and they all freaked out.
The tracker works by just listening to your heartbeat, and if there's a discontinuity,
it sounds an alarm.
It sounds an alarm. Sorry, go ahead.
So, yeah, so basically they spend all this time explaining how they would synchronize heartbeats together, and they basically would pass off the tracker
to his dog, or yeah, was that it, no, or somebody else?
Someone else, but at the same time they were talking about, well, also, you know, how he kept, you know, Bridger a secret was we basically registered him as a pet.
Right.
And so we basically gave him a tracker device that represented a dog, and he would just use the dog door to open to get in and out of the house. Like, wow, technology is really dumb.
Yes. Yes, it is.
But that is the kind of thing that by itself, it's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All the pieces together should have been awesome.
But there was all these parts in between that I didn't think were that awesome.
It's like if we can do like, it's sort of like the no Jar Jar cut of episode one. It's like, could we do like, it's like it just has like, you know, this tech stuff with like the, you know, or, the giant robot
or
fighting.
Do you really mean that, you know, the Jar Jar cut where he actually is a Sith Lord?
Yes. Well, we know he is, but.
Shh.
Yeah. I mean, there's.
I don't like this.
There are bits of this book that have like awesome technology stuff, and there's a lot of like similar political stuff that, you know, went into Infomocracy too, right? And so there's like this weird crossover of like, you know, it's kind of self-selecting, non-geography based governing that, you know, seems to have come up recently too for some reason.
Yeah, can't imagine. Yeah,
I'd like to be part of the United States, but not under the current government.
I think it kind of boils down to it's not a science fiction novel. It's not a fantasy novel. It doesn't fulfill any of the standard contracts. And I think that the answer to a lot of the, it did this really stupid thing was, well, that's what it was trying to do. So I think it succeeds on its own terms, but I'm not entirely sure what those terms are.
Or that, yeah, you want to bow or agree to the terms or whatever.
Exactly.
But you're right. You're right with the whole concept of it's not fulfilling the social contract of a sci-fi book.
Right. I mean, it has so many of the trappings of it that it leads you into having that expectation. I mean.
Right. So I think that's a lot of it is like, you know, you're like, my expectations are this, and it really didn't fulfill those. And so it's like I said, it's not like. The author can't write. It's just like, I was like, this is so not what I was expecting but beyond that, they were just like, no, I'm not really wanting to listen anymore, but now I have to, because I'm in this stupid thing where we talk about it.
I did consider boycotting this book at one point.
Yes. So listeners, we are taking suggestions on what to do if someone boycotts a book.
What is their punishment and or reward?
I had thought, well, you have to give your review as a haiku or some other poetic form. Since, you know, you don't have to have very many words to produce your partially read thing, right?
This can go wrong in so many amazing ways. No, I was really just thinking, no, then you have to review an additional book by yourself.
But I don't like that option either.
Didn't think so.
He's like, that's why I thought of it. Well, we can give a little backstory that we could. It's kind of hard to tell who to blame because, you know, Barry did sort of like dare Steve to pick it. So,
so yes, I had chosen the first one in the series. And then, you know, the second one comes out and I thought, you know, I'll spare them this. And then Barry says, oh, I dare you to pick that.
But I did not double dog dare you or triple dog dare you.
You, in fact, double dog dared me.
Damn, I went straight to the double dog dare.
You went straight to the double dog dare.
Wow.
Wow. So,
I mean, sadly, there are no direct records of this.
It's kind of a collective dare then of which I was present, but I don't think I was for or against it in any other way.
That's surprising.
Well, internally, yes, I know. Internally, I was like, oh, God, oh, God. But
yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, do we have any closing thoughts on this?
Well, we have to say, since we might not revisit this particular setting, we should say which one would you pick? Which hive would you pick?
Ah, yes. I think I would go for the Utopians. The positives are that you wear a visor that tags everything that you can improve in the environment, and they get all the cool technology, and they ride in the safest cars, and they wear incredibly cool cloaks. Downside is that you basically are constantly working to improve all of the world and to try to get everyone's ass to Mars. But,
exactly.
And then also, at least one of them seems to have a colony of ants on his face.
Wow, I completely missed
that. Yeah, I missed that too. You said, I'm not sure I'd be up for the ants. And I'm like, I'm terrified. But I remember them talking about some real ants and some fake ants.
Are those the UBs?
Yeah.
Like, they had like, some people had like snakes or something that had like sensors and other stuff on them.
Right. There was the one guy who was talking to Madame and was basically surrendering to her political ambitions.
Right.
And she said, all right, one of my terms is you must take off your mask and let me try it. And he said, okay, I'll have to evacuate it first. And all of these ants rush out of it and rush back into his hood.
Yeah, I heard part of that, but I totally did not understand what the hell was going on.
She said, are those real or fake? And he said, both.
Yeah, I heard that part, but I was like, what is he talking about? Were the ants like spies in the room or something? I missed that part.
Yeah, no, they were crawling over his face for some reason was how I took that scene. So, yes. Kevin?
Given that part, I'm less likely to want to pick the Utopian, especially because of their 60-plus-hour work week. I think I'd be happy with the 20-hour work week or whatever everyone else does. But
they work 60 hours because they wanted to.
Yeah, so
they were required for 20.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do my Apple II archivist activities and and reproduce those on Mars. So, yeah, my first thing is I wouldn't mind living on Mars right now, but so maybe I would be Utopian. On the other hand, I might be hiveless. I don't know. Anyway, Barry, would you be a Black Law? Like,
no, I actually think I'd probably be one of the cousins. I think that, you know, this whole government by trustees with a suggestion box is pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You just basically drop notes.
Is that the one that has the wish list?
No. That's the humanists.
Okay.
Yeah. So
no, the cousins are the opposite of that. And there was that whole long speech about how they were essentially female.
Oh, right. That's true.
I'm one of the few males in the cousins
that
they didn't say that. All of the members were female.
It was what traditionally was thought of as like, you know, historically, like as the feminine side of everyone's nature. It's like, okay, well, yeah, you know, they're very caring and stuff, and
right. But they also say that they have some very restrictive laws, but the punishments are very weak.
You're like, that sounds good.
This sounds like an awesome loophole.
Well, you can be Black Law. There's no rules, but then again, murder is legal too. So
I mean, at one point during the book, I think they were talking about sort of like the coalition government and how someone was gaming the system by basically recategorizing inputs into the government. You know, people, you know, voting for this or that, yeah. Right?
And this,
this sounded like this, you know, sort of like padding the suggestion box or, carefully dividing up the results to, you know, get the one you want.
But it was actually a big hoax to make it seem like the suggestion box system was working, even though it wasn't.
Right.
This is why I want to be a cousin.
To corrupt it from within?
Yes.
That does sound realistic.
I mean, I'm just emulating our dear president, so.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. Overall, I think the hive system is an interesting concept. I think there would be more than seven, though.
Yeah, I kind of like it. It's a little bit like Infomocracy. Okay, anything else we want to talk about? I don't remember if they drank tea or not.
I think there was a tea mention.
I think there was a
tea someone mention. Said, yeah, I think you said,
yeah.
There's a tea mention. You said, thank God. Yeah.
No, that was me that said, thank God.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Okay, so yes, they did mention tea. So all of our contracts are fulfilled. So
mine is a science fiction contract.
So we can move on to bigger and possibly better books, or at least.
Well, if the next one becomes the giant robot battle, then
then we're all back in.
I am going to put one in the queue just for Kevin.
All right.
Giant sex robots.
Oh, God.
I believe.
Is that Octavia Butler or?
I believe it's time for all-out war to break out. So
as we all simul strangle each other.
Exactly.
Oh, that's right.
The traditional.
Bridger just killed himself at the end because he might be too dangerous.
Well, he turns himself into the general.
Yeah, that's what I was unclear about. I'm like, did he change himself or did he kill himself?
Is that really
himself?
What happened?
Yeah, he basically. Because
I listened to it. I swear I listened to that twice this morning.
So it was the war doctor? Is that what happened?
Yes. He was basically saying, you raised me weak. Why did you do this? And I think that he had a point. He says, you know, you need somebody that is more useful
and knows all war.
Right. And it turns out that the general was actually Achilles from the Iliad.
Because I was saying, did he change himself into the general or did he kill himself? And then
both.
And then the general was just like one of the army men that he had the whole time.
The general was one of the army men that he had the whole time.
Oh, he just sort of merged and.
And so. So the army man stopped moving around and just became a toy.
Oh, okay. I thought he stopped moving around because Bridger killed himself. And
Bridger killed himself by transforming himself into the general, who was Achilles.
Wait. I think it was a little vague.
Bridger. Then you should be able to understand it.
Wait, so Bridger was that character from Ted Chiang's short story about the guy who reprogrammed himself?
actually, that was J.E.D.D. Mason.
Oh, God.
Strangle.
J.E.D.D. Mason.
J.E.D.D. Mason. Because
Masons have feelings too. Yes.
All right.
Oh, God.
This is going to be so much fun to edit.
Bucket list complete.
Okay. I think it's time for us to move on. Until next time, we are Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.